leaves all walks.
Byron couldn't be here today, but Dr. Nick is.
Yeah, very funny, very funny.
Hi, Dr. Nick.
You were listening to the Weeb Trash Can podcast. After that little segue about that, I'm not sure how to feel about anything, but yeah. So we are in October, which means spooky month.
Spooky month.
And I got some weirdos here who are scary in their own rights. I don't know; they're terrifying, but
yeah,
I'll let them introduce themselves.
I'm doing a spooky dance.
Well, it's mechanical here, creaking about from my mechanical crypt. I'm just the components of the previous mechanical just mashed together like an old Frankenstein.
Franken-mechanical!
He needs to get the bolts in his neck tightened.
Still a bit creaky.
Maggleby, I don't have a fun bit, but I am constantly surrounded by witches, so that's spooky.
And Megatron here, creeping my way straight into your heart with the smoothest voice.
He's actually a werewolf, people. Don't be fooled.
Okay. I just vacuumed. Quit shedding.
He's going to scare the cats.
To be fair, I think I'm more of a siren than a witch.
Fair enough.
I'm definitely a siren.
Well, my feet are part Roomba, so yeah, I kind of vacuum where I go.
I'd probably be a hobgoblin.
Singing to lure men to their death.
All right, so... today's episode, you love them, you hate them, maybe both.
You love to hate them.
Yes. We're talking about anime villains.
And you hate to love them.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no, seriously, that's the constant dichotomy of real good villains.
Oh, absolutely.
I love you, but you're the worst.
Absolutely. And...
Bob's Burgers.
That was not intentional, but I'll take it.
I mean, and like, they're good villains for different reasons. Some of them are good at being bad. Some of them are bad at being good. They just have to be able to fuck shit up.
Yep.
Motivations vary. And I'm gonna get this ball rolling with my patron saint of all things evil. A little fellow by the name of Dio Brando. No, I gotta say it right. Dio Brando.
Zoardo!
I gotta say right now, if there was a church for this guy, I'd probably be on board with joining this religion. That's how much I love every bastardly evil thing that he's done.
I think he'd be one of the high priests.
Yes, he would. Yes, I would. Yes,
it's okay, you got Dio on the mind.
Yes, I do. I can't help it. Dio Sama is all things evil to me.
What is Dio from? What series?
He is from a little ditty that some of you people out there on the interwebs might have heard of called JoJo's Bizarre Adventure.
Ah.
Yes. Now, first things first, for those of you who've been living on a rock, Dio got his start on the first series of the JoJo line, Phantom Blood. He started off as the adopted brother of Jonathan Joestar, the very first JoJo introduced in the JoJo's Bizarre Adventure line. He is the son of Dario Brando, a small-time thug who ended up saving Jonathan's father from like a carriage crashing. He was going to rob him, but then Jonathan's father came too, and he's like, "You saved us. I owe you a debt." So Jonathan's father gives Dario his ring, and just says, "Whenever you need anything, you just call me." So Dario just holds on to that favor for something special. Meanwhile, he has his own little boy, Dio, who he's basically raising him to be his own special type of scallywag. And on Dario's deathbed, he gives Dio the ring and he says, make good on this. Take the Joestar family for everything they're worth. And he basically does that. Fast forward, he moves into the Joestar household, and he's killing Jonathan's dog. He's making the moves on Jonathan's girlfriend, and he's just trying to do everything he can to make it seem like he's the better son, while still fucking with the protagonist JoJo, or Jonathan in this case. Fast forward a couple years, they're somehow close friends. They act more like brothers. Meanwhile, Jonathan has become an archaeologist. Well, an archaeology student. And he's studying this stone mask. And Dio gets his hands on it and sees that it has murder capabilities. So he tests it out on some random old dude in London. Turns him into a vampire. So this kind of changes his plans for trying to use the mask to kill Jonathan's father and Jonathan so he can take fortune. So he saves it for a rainy day. He gets caught trying to kill Jonathan's father, and he uses the mask to become a vampire. And this is when he becomes the villain that so many people love to hate. Dio basically is doing everything he can to create his own army of vampires, all dedicated to him. He does some of those heinous acts, including taking the stone mask, making a promise to a mother and child, saying, like, if you become a vampire, I won't kill your child. He turns to the woman, and she eats her child. And then he says, I said I wouldn't!
Wow.
And it was, you know, it's just little things like that that kind of make Dio such an irredeemable bastard, but he's so good at being bad because you learn from his upbringing that he never had a redeeming quality to him. He was kind of just like, I'm just bad. There's nothing else to say about it. It's not to say that he's not without honor. At the end of Phantom Blood, he when he's just ahead at this point, he goes to Jonathan on his wedding night and says, you've earned my respect so much that I want your body. Like, literally, like, he wants to cut off Jonathan's head and take over his body. So in that sense, he respects anyone that can really do damage to him. And then we fast forward a couple of generations to Stardust Crusaders, which is where most people know Dio from, where he basically is at it with the Joestar family again. This time, he got his head and Jonathan's body. He's sowing his wild oats, creating offspring just because he can. And he is waging war against the Joestar family. He's pitting more mothers and children against each other. He even got, like, animals doing his bidding. And I can't go into much more detail about it without spoiling Stardust Crusaders, because it's a much lengthier series than Phantom Blood. But needless to say, Dio's a bastard, and I could go on forever about why.
Say, even as a bastard, so does he have, like, a particular M.O.? Does he have a code of conduct that makes sense in his own twisted mind, but to nobody else?
Well, I mean, if I had to break it down, it's just no one in life ever gave him a chance, so why should he give anybody a chance?
Okay.
If I, like, in its simplest form, he is, like, the embodiment of that mindset, because, like I said, his father treated him like shit. He was raised from a little whelp to take everybody and everything for as far as he can get. It kind of sucks, but that's, like, there are plenty of people in the real world that are like that.
Yeah. Right? So it sounds like he's just perpetuating the cycle of villainy and abuse, basically, but he's aware of it and doesn't give a shit.
Exactly.
Okay. It's that self-awareness is what makes villains really, really scary and less pitiable.
Absolutely. And, like, how powerful he is as a villain. Like, he's aware of how strong he is, especially as a vampire. When he realizes that he can flash freeze things or shoot lasers from his eyes that can move at will. There's something very terrifying about an opponent that knows the limits of their opponents and knows how limitless they are.
It's like some Sun Tzu shit right there.
Absolutely.
Yep.
What you got for your mechanical?
Well, I'm going into one of my favorites from Gundam 0083, Stardust Memory. Now, you're thinking I might go with Gato, Anvil Gato, the Nightmare of Solomon. Mm-hmm. No. He does have some redeeming quality. He's doing his pretty much on honor. Like, he was still siding with his side. But who I'm going with, it's Shima Garahal. She is one of the recruited members of Neo Zeon after the 1 Year War. This series took place after the original Gundam series and just before Zeta Gundam. So it sort of like bridges like the technological gap between the two and how things got to what they are. during the 1 year war, she was one of the commanders of the colony drop, like on site, like in the mobile suit squads.
Yeah,
she pretty much got blacklisted like during and after the war by the Zeon just for her part in that. She had like major beef with the Principality of Zeon because later on in the 1 year war, they pretty much evacuated her colony and converted it into like a colony laser, which was used to wipe out 2/3 of the Federation force. But yeah, during Stardust Memory, she's recruited by the Dalaz fleet, which is Zeon remnants. They're planning on getting sovereignty back to space immigrants. But somewhere along the lines, like, it pretty much goes to another colony drop.
Hmm.
Yeah, you know, she's just incorrigible with that mass murder.
If you first you don't succeed,
drop it again.
Right?
But, like, her tactics, she's an ace pilot, but she likes to toy with, like, her targets. Like, she likes to string them along a bit to sort of get the most misery out of them.
Yeah.
Like, she doesn't go directly for the kill shot. She cripples and then kills.
Yeah.
You know, just pick at that moon, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's been a while since I've seen Stardust Memories, but she looks like a very cruel piece of work.
Mm-hmm.
What about her, makes her so dastardly to you?
Well, she kind of set the groundwork for the Titans organization to rise up in the Federation. They're kind of like the Blackwater of the Federation Army, the private military contractors. Yeah, so she was the one that set that stone skipping and built up into the monster it became years later.
Does she live through the end of the series, or...?
Nope. She gets her comeuppance.
Nice.
Her arrogance gets the best of her, and she's caught off guard by a detachable arm from a mobile armor.
Oh, shit.
Which pretty much, like, blasts her mech completely in half. And if you do know the anatomy of your mobile suits, that cockpit is right in the solar plexus.
Yeah,
it is, huh? I'm just visualizing that scene in my head. It's usually like a clean.
It's like she was coming down for like the kill strike, and it was like, boom. Nice.
What's one of the most heinous things that she's done in the show?
See, one of the most heinous things. Let's see. She funded the building of mobile armor by a veteran of the Zeon army. Who was, he was an amputee from the war, but, like, he, like, built it specifically for him to be able to use, like, one arm. And, like, it's like, you know what, yeah, you did all this work, but I'm getting one of my men to pilot this instead.
Wow, how...
She pulls the rug out of a lot of people.
So she's ableist, too. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty fucking cruel.
Yep.
He was like, your glory will be knowing that you built this grand design. He was like, you bitch.
How many babies does she kick? How many puppies does she kick, I mean?
Not many puppies, but she did kill Admiral Dalaz when she like fully went turncoat for like the Titans.
Oh jeez. And the Titans, they were some nasty
they were far worse than the Zeon.
Oh, that's right. They were like the enforcers of like the New Earth Federation, huh?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Like any means necessary.
Yep.
All right. Is there anything else you want to add about them? About her? I mean,
let's see. Well, the pattern color of her mobile suit is primarily like the core is purple, while the head, arms, and legs are like olive green colored.
This is a Zaku, right?
No, she pilots a Gelgoog, which is a high mobility, high output mobile suit from like the end of the 1 year war.
Okay, I think I'm trying to. Remind me of that design again.
It doesn't have the tubes on the side. It has the fin on the back. It's like more streamlined head. It's got those sort of jagged shoulders.
Oh yeah.
And it has like the like the beam naginata, the dual edge, sort of yes, like...
I know exactly which one you're talking about.
Like, the best way I can describe it for you listeners would be, think of Darth Maul's lightsabers, double-edged, but think more of, like, glaive ends.
Yep.
Mm. All right, well, that sounds like a pretty heinous... I don't want to use the B word, but yeah.
We already have. Why yeah. not?
Well, yeah, she is.
Yeah, she's a heinous little bitch.
Thank you.
Yes.
On to you, Maccabee.
All right. I am going to talk about villain who's particularly terrifying to me because this whole series takes place as something realistic. So I'm going to be talking about Johann Liebert from Monster. In case you haven't heard of Monster, which I would not blame you for, it is not a super well-known series.
Yeah.
Monster follows Dr. Kenzo Tenma, who is a prestigious surgeon and in line to basically be the head of the hospital. He's seriously dating the current head of the hospital's daughter, so he is all set to be the most successful surgeon, both politically and because he is legitimately one of the most talented surgeons to ever come along. So one night, a little boy comes in with a bullet wound to the head. And he's ready to go in and perform surgery on this little boy to remove the bullet. And suddenly the mayor comes in and also needs brain surgery. So they send him, say, hey, Dr. Tenma, you do the surgery on the mayor because it's the more prestigious, even though it's the easier procedure. We're going to send this other guy to jump in and do the little boy, even though he's not prepared for it and he's nowhere near as skilled as you. Dr. Tenma says, no, this other guy does not have the skill set to do the little boy. Let him do the mayor. Everything will be fine. I have to go do the right thing. So he does, and that leads to this other surgeon suddenly getting all the political power, and Dr. Tenma is slowly phased out of the hospital, and his career is basically ended because he chose to do the right thing. The little boy he saved is Johann Liebert, who is the titular monster of the series.
Yep.
He's a sociopath. He's even before the bullet wound happened. There's no real talk about how that might have... He was a normal kid and the bullet wound changed something in his brain. No, he has always been an emotionless, calculating, evil individual. I mean, he's basically a nihilist. Major quote of his from later in life that kind of encompasses his philosophy is... There's nothing special about being born. Not a thing. Most of the universe is just death. Nothing more. In this universe of ours, the birth of a new life in some corner of our planet is nothing but a tiny, insignificant flash. Death is a normal thing. So why live? His goal is to die, but to be the last person standing. He wants to take out as much of humanity as he possibly can. Now, how that fits into this series is that there are only two people on the planet that Johann respects in any way, shape, or form. One of which is his twin sister, Nina, because they're twins, they've always had this connection, and Nina has always recognized that something's not right with Johann, and tried to tell people that something's not right with Johann, and no one believed her. The other person he respects is Dr. Tenma for saving his life and for essentially throwing away his career to do the right thing to save the life of a little boy. Now, he recognizes that this morality is something special and is, in his eyes, something completely unique in this world. No one else in the breadth of humanity has the kind of moral backbone, the moral fiber that Dr. Tenma showed in saving him. So he has both the admiration of Dr. Tenma being the only decent person on the planet, and also the feeling of basically a life debt that you saved my life, and logically I need to acknowledge that. So what he does is he says, Tenma, I'ma save you for last. And it becomes part of his mission to essentially break Tenma. Tenma becomes kind of this ideal to him. And in order to continue being the heartless, nihilistic, mass-murdering psychopath that he is, he kind of makes it a personal mission to bring Tenma to his side. Not to get Tenma to, like, be his accomplice or anything, but to make Tenma see that, no, what I'm doing is the right thing. Humanity is hopeless. Dr. Tenma spends his whole life, after he basically finds out who and what Johan is, he feels personally responsible for saving this child and for therefore allowing this monster to live and wreak havoc on the world. So he makes it his personal mission to track down and either incarcerate or kill, but somehow end Johan. And that's the entire series, is the dichotomy between these two, of the polarization of not... On a surface read, it's kind of a good versus evil, a hope versus hopelessness, but it goes so much deeper.
Yeah, it sounds like it has the bricks for something much deeper.
It is an absolutely fascinating series, because you also have the twin sister Nina weaving in and out of this narrative. You have all of the people that Johan uses and manipulates weaving in and out of the narrative, both good people who got screwed over by him and bad people that he uses as tools, but he is an absolutely terrifying force of nature to watch because he is so cold and calculating and emotionless, and that is a thing that does exist in this world. Absolutely. It is very, very rare, but it is a thing that exists. We have a name for it, sociopath. Yeah. And watching someone like him who's just having that sociopathic tendency coupled with an extreme intelligence is truly terrifying to watch.
One thing that I remember from my watching of this show that you sparked with me, the duality, like the fact that you have a killer and someone who protects life, someone who saves life.
Yep.
That's definitely something that was never really lost on me. And yeah, like their relationship was interwoven, like, again, giving up, he lost everything, and by taking care of Johan, it's like, okay, this is all I have left. And it's really such an amazing thought-provoking mm-hmm. narrative.
Mm-hmm. It really is, and part of the reason that Dr. Tenma keeps going after him is because Johan and the hospital actually end up framing him for criminal malpractice. Dr. Tenma is actually on the run and trying to track down Johan because he has nothing left in his professional life, which was his entire life. And he has to be careful going through towns because both him being on the run from essentially a murder charge that resulted from criminal malpractice that he is innocent of, he's also following in the wake of Johan, who is constantly manipulating events around him. So he keeps getting sort of he keeps getting caught up in the wake of Johan's messes. And so he becomes, society viewing him, sees this downfall of this guy who keeps now getting blamed for worse and worse and worse things that Johan is essentially setting up to get Tenma to hate humanity as much as he does.
It's very film noir in that way.
It is. It is. Which may be why I like it so much.
Yeah. It almost sounds like what the Joker tries to do to Batman every turn.
Yes. No, it really is. It's that Johan has an incredible respect for Tenma. And Johan does plan on seeing Tenma die at some point because he wants everyone to die. He wants the world to die. And that includes Tenma and Nina. But he's saving them for last because he respects them. And he doesn't expect to rule over an empty world. In the end, he says, no, I also want to die. Once I've cleansed the earth, there's no place for me here. I'm going to make sure that this happens, and then I myself am going to die, and that will be my final piece. That's my ultimate goal, is to die myself.
I highly recommend anyone listening to this to check it out if you haven't. It's kind of an older series, but I'm almost certain Funimation has the rights to it. It looks like the live actions... Oh, nope, I'm...
Manga series as well, but I have not read the manga.
Mm-hmm.
The manga is, it looks like 18 volumes. List of monster episodes, and it is how many episodes long? 74 episode series.
I was about to say, like, what, 50s?
74 episodes. And if you enjoy psychological, cerebral stuff like this, it's an amazing watch, and the artwork is beautiful. I love this series, I really do, but it's definitely not for anyone. If you have ADHD, maybe don't watch this series, because I can guarantee you, it will not hold your attention.
Why isn't it flashing? Why is there no kaboom?
There is no, saying that it's very noir is right. It holds a very serious, very subdued tone the entire time.
It has, and like we were mentioning, it has like that one major constant trope of the downfall of the protagonist.
Yeah.
Trying to have like those external forces trying to bring them down.
It's an incredible series, and Johan is a truly terrifying antagonist.
Okay. All right, so we are going to move away from that somber Johan Lieberman up into the stars to Mars with Vicious from the Red Dragon Clan in Cowboy Bebop.
Yes.
So Vicious, when I think of Vicious, the word vehement comes to mind.
Vehement, yes. Yep.
And so when you first meet Vicious, he is sequestering one of the head capos of the Red Dragon Clan, which is also a clan that Spike Spiegel used to come from, that he faked his death to escape. And he takes over, stating that all of you have lost your fangs and deserve to die. Fangs meaning you've lost your will to fight. So right off the bat, you get a sense that Vicious is all about fighting and killing and being merciless and just getting all up in there.
There is no subtlety to his name.
There is no subtlety at all.
Because the capos were there signing a peace deal.
That's right. The capos were signing a peace deal. And then you see the rival capo flying off. And then boom. His ship bows up. And then all his goons run in. And Mao Yen Rai. He's like, you know, if Spike were alive, you wouldn't do any of this. And that's when Vicious just drags the blade right across his throat.
Mm.
So the reason why I chose Vicious, other than his namesake and his forwardness, is because he represents the elements of what a villain is supposed to be. So Harry Potter, you have Voldemort. Star Wars, you have Darth Vader. It's both the same person as the protagonist. They've just taken a different route.
Absolutely.
When you look at Spike... Spike has just been trying to find a sense of peace in his life, which is why he escaped the Red Dragon Clan with the hopes of, spoiler alert, getting with Julia. None of that happened, but Vicious was also entangled with Julia. So immediately we have a love triangle.
Yes.
And so Vicious being the type of person that he is, where he loves to fight, he loves war, think of the outside of heaven where it's a constant battleground. He ends up chasing Spike through the galaxy just because he realizes that he's alive. So if you want to look at it canonically in the series without having to go through all the other episodes, it's episode 1, so you get some background story. Episode 5, episode 12 and 13, and then the last two episodes. You start to get a sense of who Vicious is, why he is the way he is. You get some of his background on the War on Titan. But this dude is by all means his namesake. So he goes around staging coups. He goes around killing people. And he ends up becoming the reason why Spike has to go back and chase his past. And so there's a lot of poetic senses that come out in Cowboy Bebop that we've covered before on the show, where Spike has two kinds of eyes. He has his real eye and an artificial eye. And he says that he sees the present with one and the past with the other. And it's like he's always in a dream. That's something that is echoed a lot in the series, especially when you see him reunite with Julia. And the whole idea is for them to escape that dream and to no longer have to deal with the lives that they've led so far. But Vicious is the one foil to that. Just the same way that Darth Vader being Luke Skywalker's dad is the one foil to him being the savior. And just like Voldemort is tied to Harry Potter, that's like his foil. Yes. So Vicious is a perfect archetype villain because he and Spike share so much in common. They're both mafiosos. They were both enforcers. And they led the same type of lifestyle up until Spike broke away from that lifestyle. Vicious continued in that lifestyle. And he, being who he is, decided he didn't want any kind of peace and he just wants blatant war. So in Jupiter Jazz, which is episodes 12 and 13, I think, or 13 and 14, I'm not too sure. He goes so far as to steal a shipment of Red Eye, which is the drug that they're going after. He takes this shipment, pays for it with a bomb just to screw everybody over, and then jets out of the place that they're at. And that's all just to piss off the Red Dragon clan so they can make a move against them to force their hand so he can take them over. That's how calculating this guy is.
Yeah.
Yes.
So that's why I pick Vicious, because he is a textbook villain. He is his namesake, and he is very, very evil.
I really like to think specifically of Vicious and Spike as both being different aspects of chaos.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yep.
If you were going to put D&D terms onto it, Spike rides the line between chaotic good and chaotic neutral.
Yep.
Yeah.
Versus Vicious rides the line between chaotic neutral and chaotic evil.
Mm-hmm. I just say straight up chaotic evil, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. One thing that I really applaud Vicious for, as far as his heinous acts, Spike trusted this woman with everything he had.
Mm-hmm.
He was prepared to walk away from everything he'd ever known just for her. And the fact that one act could jade a man so much shows the effects that Vicious has as a villain.
Because you were talking about how he's the ultimate villain archetype, is that goes back even so far beyond the examples you were giving to. He's a very Shakespearean villain.
Mm.
He was pouring poison in Julia's ear this whole time to manipulate her to this point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's like in terms of like the alignment gradient, there's no neutrality in his actions.
Absolutely.
Well, except yes and no, because he is always looking out for number one, but he also revels in chaos
itself. Yeah.
Which is why I said that he rode the line between neutral and evil.
Okay.
Because so I feel like he does, at the end of the day, both Spike and he are ultimately looking out for themselves and their goals, but when push comes to shove, Spike will not cross a line and Spike has a set of morals and codes that lean him more towards the good spectrum, versus Vicious will absolutely cross that line and does not mind letting other people fall into his chaos. That's the main difference between the two of them.
Yep. Yeah, Spike has respect.
Spike has respect. It comes down to respect for the other people around you, both the people that you know and care for, and the general populace. Spike will function within chaos. He actually functions very well within chaos. It's kind of where he thrives.
Yep.
Which we talked a lot about during the soundtrack episode and how that's reflected in the jazz.
Yep.
Vicious thrives in chaos to the point where he actively creates it, not just as his own environment, but as an environment for everybody else. And he doesn't care that other people don't want to or cannot function within that sense of chaos.
Yep.
And it is an interesting the fact that he was in the War on Titan. He's a former soldier. All he knows is war.
All he knows is violence.
Yeah. And, I mean, we don't know anything about him growing up, but that had to come from somewhere. So, it's like, when all you know is that way of life, similar to Dio, you're going to project that because this is the only thing, is your only reality.
Yeah, he went from being, you know, a soldier to basically a mafioso.
Mm-hmm.
Versus I think Spike was really brought up in that, you know, again, if we're talking about the mafia, there's always those two sides to it. There's the side of the mafia within the community where you look out for your own, and then there's the pure violent side. And I feel like Spike was adopted into this organization through the community aspect versus Vicious came in as an extension of the violence aspect.
Yeah, for sure. Because, I mean, I don't want to get too far off topic, but more to what you're saying is that Spike, he goes and visits Annie, the keeper of the shop.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And there's pictures of him with Mao Yenrai. And, you know, Spike falls in love.
Yeah.
Like, hard in love. But Vicious, he's just literally, like, trying to create this world where he can continue being a shark. Because if a shark stops, it dies. Well, he's trying to continue this world where he can keep being a shark.
I like that allegory of him being a shark where he physically can't stop. And that harkens back to his first major series confrontation with Spike where he talks about how you are, you know, you're an agent of chaos like me. You lead a violent life. And Spike says, I bled all that blood away.
Yeah, he says, so they have like this one standoff. And Spike has a gun to his head and Vicious has a sword to his throat. He's like, you know what you look like right now? And Spike says, what? And Vicious says, you look like a ravenous beast. And that's when Spike says, no, I bled all that blood away.
Yeah.
It's so intense.
It's very good, but it harkens back to that shark metaphor that you were saying is that he doesn't want to bleed that blood away. He wants to continue living in that world versus Spike died.
Yep.
And with him died that part of his life.
Yep.
I do want to bring up that fight scene from Jupiter Jazz where when the guys are going to rob Spike, call him Vicious. Mm-hmm. It just triggered him so much.
Chills. I have chills. Yeah. I wasn't thinking about that. But oh my God.
That because like as soon as you said I bled that blood away, it's like I think about it, like, did you really? Because as soon as you heard someone call you that, you were like, fuck you guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, single-handedly unarmed Spike takes down like 7 guys.
Mm-hmm.
Because someone used the term vicious specifically, and he has so much that word, therefore, obviously automatically reminds him of the name, and that name is so indicative of all of the conflict and feelings of helplessness associated with that world. His past is wrapped up in 2 names,
mm-hmm.
in Vicious and Julia.
And can I just say, that is probably one of the defining moment of Steve Bloom's career, that line, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
That line, his delivery, when I'm just like, God damn, I hope I never piss him off that much. Mm-hmm. He's like, you don't know what Vicious is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I've never
felt that. Except I was going to say, you did it all like gravelly, but he's like, ugh, I can't describe it.
He does it in that Steve Bloomy voice. You just can't.
So good, but yeah, because no matter how serious Spike ever gets, there's still that
playfulness.
That playfulness. Yeah. That little bit of levity, that little bit of like, I don't actually care.
Yep.
And he loses that completely. Ugh, and Vicious is what brings that out of him.
Yep.
Again, the mark of a perfect villain.
Yep.
Alright, so we're gonna change form a little bit after that fun little go around. We all have one that we want to talk about.
Together.
Yes, as a family.
That's funny.
Yeah, because we're going to talk about, as a family, the character known as Father from Full Metal Alchemist. From specifically the anime, he is only in Brotherhood. Because Brotherhood follows the manga, and he's in the manga. Mm-hmm. So the manga Full Metal Alchemist includes Father. If you're just focusing on the anime, Father is in Brotherhood only. but as we were all in a chat together bandying about who we were going to talk about, I think I put up a quick list of people I was going to talk about, and all three of these guys went, Maggie, really? You're not going to talk about Father? And I was like, okay, I get how I'm a major proponent of FMA, and you'd all expect me to say this, but I feel like everybody's watched this. And it led into a really long conversation about really breaking down this character, and all of us decided as a group that we wanted to have that conversation on air.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So I'll get the ball rolling, I guess, for this one. Father, also known as, started his existence out as the dwarf in the flask.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Essentially the very first homunculus.
Yep.
He forms a very close bond with Hohenheim. And
He basically learns about humanity. Yep. He is the first documented homunculus. He doesn't have a body. He's this little, think of it as almost like a Miyazaki soot sprite.
Yes.
That's, you know, in a flask. And Hohenheim is essentially is the apprentice, is the slave. He starts out as a slave a nameless slave under this alchemist, and eventually garners all the knowledge of working in this environment. And becomes, I think he becomes an apprentice, doesn't he? Or does he stay a nameless slave? Yeah, he eventually becomes an apprentice. But he strikes up honestly, a friendship with the nameless homunculus in the jar, in the flask. And in learning about the world essentially through the eyes of a slave and being treated as a non-entity himself, basically the homunculus gets a very warped view on humanity, and eventually he is ultimately responsible for the destruction of, what is the society called? Yeah. Xerxes. All right, so back. Is ultimately responsible for the destruction of Xerxes, which is a major ruin of a civilization in both iterations of the series. And it's this huge mystery in both series of what happened to Xerxes, because it's almost like a Pompeii-type situation, where everything is still there and perfect, and suddenly there are just no people.
Yep.
And it's because the creature in the flask did, for the first time, but not the last time, the giant countrywide ritual that takes all the souls from all of the human beings and turns it into a philosopher's stone.
Yep. Philosopher's Stone is people!
Yes, Xerxes is the first Philosopher's Stone. And Hohenheim is the only person who is spared from that. And as a tribute to Hohenheim, the homunculus takes on Hohenheim's appearance.
Yep.
And that is the body that he chooses to generate for himself, that he chooses to walk around in.
Technically, aren't they both Philosopher's Stones, since they're comprised of all the souls? Like, the homunculus in the flask, his body is comprised of all, like, the souls that were just, like, entered into
that is correct, because Hohenheim, or not Hohenheim, the father, we'll refer to him from here on out as Father.
That's easier.
Father essentially creates his Hohenheim body using the Philosopher's Stone that is Xerxes.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, Hohenheim himself is, I hesitate to say that he is a Philosopher's Stone, but he comes from and draws power from the Philosopher's Stone, yeah. because that then gets into, well, does that make Lust a Philosopher's Stone? Does that make every single successful homunculus that we see in the series that Father creates? Father is the creator of all the homunculi and is the mastermind behind the plot that we get to see in Fullmetal Alchemist of him trying to do the same thing to Amestris that he did to Xerxes, mm-hmm. to create another Philosopher's Stone. And every homunculus that he has created, he has essentially created from, if not the destruction of a country, the equivalent loss of life of the destruction of a country. He was the mastermind behind all of the major wars in Amestris, the
Ishval.
Yes, he was the mastermind behind Ishval because he wanted the blood, the souls, to create a new child. Not that he has any fatherly or familial love for these children. They're literally just he's creating tools to continue his essentially systemic purging of humanity.
They're more like concentrations of the lesser aspects of humanity that
yes.
he, exactly,
that yeah. he exudes outside of himself. So
they
he can
are
be
the worst
more
aspects, yes.
more pure being.
Which is why they're named after
they're named after the seven deadly sins because yeah. They are born of mass loss of life. They are born of humanity solidified and then manifest as a particular one of the worst traits of humanity, right. each one of them. Or at least that's how it's supposed to be. All of them are obviously much more nuanced characters as we come to find out. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But Father's intention is to surround himself constantly, to have his children each represent the worst aspects of humanity. And he never outright says it, but honestly, it's gotta just be as a constant reminder of why he hates humanity so much.
Mm-hmm.
Must get this out of me.
Yeah.
So I don't need it. And in certain ways, it kind of reminds me of the dynamic between Kami and Piccolo, where Kami purged all of his evil from Piccolo Daimo, and then tried to seal him off.
Except that he doesn't purge any of his feelings from him. Like, he doesn't end up as a Johann. He ends up, yes, as very calculating, and he can come off as emotionless, but during confrontations, he lets emotion come through. He right, yes. yells, he gets upset, he does, like, he has by no means purged these sins from himself by creating these embodiments of them.
Yeah, because he can never seem to purge his arrogance from him either.
No, mm-mm. no. He is, if anything, I know that there is a, you know, there is a pride homunculus, but Father really oldest. Is, Father is pride personified. He is yes. arrogance. He sees himself as better than everything and everyone.
How about this quote from Ed? Where was your father to help you when you were weakened? As he said to Pride,
mm-hmm.
when like he was already like pretty much coming apart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I really like a lot of the dynamic that they do between Father and the homunculi, and specifically greed.
Yeah, because mm-hmm. that's like a real so greed. Right off the bat, you can tell he has like daddy issues, and it's because of that. Crazy
he literally,
relationship.
Yeah.
That they
no,
have.
He literally dissolves greed
mm-hmm.
to get back to basically, well, you're a failed experiment,
mm-hmm.
and dissolves him to get the pure stone back and creates a new greed.
Mm-hmm. Well, he reincorporates it back into himself to sort of like.
Yes.
The whole mixing, matching, whatever the hell happens inside.
He's very scary. Yeah.
One thing I wanted to bring up is how his ultimate fate, even at the verge of his final defeat, when he's at the gate of truth, he's like, I just need to try something a little bit different. Just give me one chance. I must have done something wrong. Experiment.
And he was back at the Homunculus in the class form.
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because that's his true form. The form that we see in him for the vast majority of the season is literally just a stolen form.
Yep.
Yes. And as you were saying, how he has the skewed view of humanity, that shines through in that moment where he's just like, this was all just an experiment to him. This was all just, like, again, he saw no value in life whatsoever.
The hundreds and hundreds of years of just constant violence and purposeful orchestration of loss of life was just...
Just for the hell of it.
Just for the hell of it. Just trying to figure out what makes these things tick.
Oh, man. Well, this has been a very good discussion, and I'm sure we keep this going on for a good couple of hours, but...
Roughly.
I was going to say, there's our anime we can't stop talking about episodes that Megatron and I were not able to participate in. FMA is the thing that I want to talk about. And we do plan on doing another episode at some point with just Megatron and I where we get to gush.
Yes.
It'll be like blubber in a box. Just keep bouncing all over the place.
So I was going to say, when that happens, especially it being Magleby and Megatron, expect some deep dive existential bullshit.
Oh, yeah.
Sounds great, guys. I will start off with my runner-up then. Nakago from Fushigi Yugi. And that's really about all I want to say about him, because he's not as great as I used to think he was.
My runner-up is Harry McDowell from Gungrave.
Nice.
Yep. Mafioso crime boss who's a sociopathic, not a enabler, it's a manipulator.
Yeah.
He pulls a lot of strings to get what he wants. And
hubris.
Yes.
Hubris.
I had a list, my short list of trying to figure out who to talk about included Medusa from Soul Eater, Legato Bluesummers from Trigun, QB from Madoka, and Dr. Meraki from Descendants of Darkness. Yes. And we've talked briefly about Medusa and Dr. Meraki on the show in the past. And then I ended up going with Johann Liebert, so...
So for me, my runner-up would probably be Cell from Dragon Ball Z.
Nice.
Oh, man. So.
Villains. Love to hate them, hate to love them.
Yeah. And one of the best marks of a really good villain is the duality against a protagonist or multiple protagonists. You know, with Dio, it's the Joestar family, you know, that... Especially, I see that more with Jonathan because he was a much more stalwart hero type. Any Gundam series you can think of, there you'll see that duality because it's war.
Everywhere.
Mm-hmm. It's war and duality. It's
one side against another.
Yes. The point of having a protagonist and an antagonist is to have the opposites conflicting with each other and being foils to each other. The only reason to have a villain and antagonist in a series is to provide not just a challenge on every single conceivable level to the protagonist.
But yeah, same thing. Batman, Joker, one bad day.
Yep.
So on that note, I'm Byron D0. You guys have a good Halloween. If you just listen to this episode around that time, Ja Matana.
This is mechanical, sinking ever slowly into the food grinder. I guess I'm being repurposed into a new model! Recycling!
Magleby, peace out.
Megatron, goodbye.